Chapter 11, Inheritance, by Tremaine Lee. In Josephine Bolin McCall's living room in Montgomery, Alabama, a black and white photograph of her parents, Elmore Bolin and Bertha Mae Nowden Bolin, rests on an easel. Her father is seated with his back straight, wearing a black driver's hat cocked perfectly on his head like a crown. Her mother stands dutifully by his side with a hand on his shoulder. The mounted photograph is large, about 2 feet wide by 3 feet tall, but feels even larger. Somehow, it seems to fill the whole room. It was taken in the mid-1940s, when things were good for the Bolin family. Elmore Bolin was a one-man economy in Lounsboro, where the family lived. He had a large house, a general store, a delivery service, a catering company, and a gas station, all of which were located on a property he leased off Highway 80, one of the most traveled routes between Selma and Montgomery. He grew cotton, corn, and sugarcane, and owned a small fleet of trucks. At his peak, Bolin employed as many as 40 people, all of them black like him. And his family estimates that he had as much as $40,000 in the bank and more than $5,000 in physical assets, together worth more than $500,000 in today's dollars. Bolin came from a long line of black entrepreneurs that stretched back to the early post-slavery days. From them, he learned how to be successful in the Jim Crow South. In the late 1800s and early 1900s, his father and grandfather had managed to acquire a large plot of land on which they ran cattle. But just as they were getting ahead, a white man who'd been renting a parcel of land from them claimed that the land was his. Black people had no legal standing when it came to business matters with white folks, so he was able to simply take it from the Bolins. After that, the Bolin men vowed never to buy property again. Instead, they would lease it. On rented land, which could never be stolen from them, they could still set up numerous money-making ventures. That's how Elmore Bolin grew up, thinking a few steps ahead of white people, always weighing the risk of being black and ambitious against new business opportunities. He leased his farmland and raised his animals, and then got into transportation and deliveries, too. He started with a mule and a wagon, and eventually upgraded to a Model T, which he converted into a truck. Bolin transported cattle and feed and anything that anyone wanted to move between Lowndes County and Montgomery. Soon, his Model T grew into three tractor-trailer trucks. But it was the expansion of his little general store that changed his fortunes. Elmore and Bertha Mae started doing Friday night fish fries, serving Sunday dinners, and selling ice cream to the after-church crowd. Ice cream was a delicacy in their little patch of the county, where most folks still didn't have electricity. They used a portable hand-cranked ice cream maker to churn out scoops of the cold stuff for eager customers. The shop became the center of the family's operation, and they grew their business by adding a one-pump gas station out front. Elmore got the idea to sell gas after a white-owned station nearby refused to serve him. At the Bolin's pump, black drivers would have a safe, reliable place to fill up. In addition to their successful businesses, Elmore and Bertha Mae had 7 children. He sent his 2 oldest sons to live with their aunt in Montgomery during the week so they could attend school in the city instead of going to the local high school, where the focus was on working the land rather than book learning. "Our father decided that those schools offered a better education," McCall says of her dad, who never learned to read or write. He always preached to his children that getting a good education and achieving financial independence were the only ways black folks would ever experience any kind of freedom. He had very little of the former, but was dead set on grabbing up as much of the latter as he could. In the portrait in McCall's living room, he almost pops from the frame. His rich brown skin glows against his white shirt and light tie. Bertha Mae leans into him as if he were a boulder. There's a mix of pride and defiance on his face. It took a lot of both to survive and thrive as a black man. But too much of either could just as easily be one's undoing, and he knew it. They all did. Not long after that portrait was taken, the Bowlings and every black man, woman, and child in the county would learn the cost of daring to be too successful, too free. On a mild December day in 1947, a deputy sheriff came to Elmore's store while his 12-year-old son, Willie D., was working and asked where his father was. Willie D. told him that his father was away on a trip. A short time later, another white man entered and asked the same question. Willie D. knew this meant trouble, but he didn't know what to do. Sensing danger, he told the man that his father wasn't in town. Soon after, Willie D. saw the first man's car following his father's truck on the highway about 200 yards from the store as Elmore, back from Montgomery, attempted to make some deliveries. As Elmore got out of his truck, two white men confronted him, including one of the men who'd come into the store. It seemed that in buying a pump and selling gas, Elmore had stepped over some invisible line. Suddenly, gunfire rang out. The white men shot Elmore 7 times, 6 times with a pistol, and once with a shotgun blast to his back. His wife and 3 of his children, all under the age of 13, heard the terrifying sounds and rushed from the store to find him lying dead in a ditch. McCall says the shooters didn't bother to cover their faces. They didn't need to. Everyone would know who had killed Elmore and why. Enraged whites, jealous over the business success of a Negro, are believed to be the lynchers of Elmore Bowling, reported the Chicago Defender on December 20th, 1947. The story noted that Bowling has long been a marked man. One local who knew Elmore put it succinctly, he was too successful to be a Negro. His murder created a gaping wound in the family, which quickly lost everything he'd built. Growing up, we never talked much about what happened, McCall says all these years later, sitting on an orange velvet love seat in her meticulously kept living room, not far from the portrait of her parents. We were all traumatized by it in our own way, she said. The trauma reverberated over the years after her father's lynching, and in addition to the emotional pain, there was the ongoing financial toll. There was no inheritance, says McCall. Nothing for my father to pass down, because it was all taken away. The fate suffered by Elmore Bowling and his family was not unique to them or to Jim Crow Alabama. It was part of a broader social and political campaign to violently safeguard the racial hierarchy that had begun as a reaction to Reconstruction and would stretch over the next century. When legal slavery ended in 1865, the formerly enslaved had great hopes. During the next 5 years, the Reconstruction Amendments established birthright citizenship, making all black people citizens and granting them equal protection under the law, and gave black men the right to vote. For the first time in this country's history, black people had a path to achieving some kind of political power. But it was a tenuous path that could be pursued only with protection. In the South, where millions of formerly enslaved people were attempting to claim their freedom and begin building their lives, the federal government maintained a military presence. This, alongside black local and regional self-protection efforts, helped to keep order. These troops were able to briefly hold back some of the most violent and oppressive elements in the South, enabling black men to exercise their new rights, casting ballots, and mounting political campaigns. For the first time, black men were elected to local and state office. Reconstruction was an enormous undertaking. To oversee the transition from slavery to freedom, Congress established the Freedmen's Bureau, which provided food, housing, legal assistance, and medical aid to newly emancipated citizens. The agency helped fund the building of thousands of schools for Black children and young people, as biracial Reconstruction governments built the first systems of free public elementary education in the South. These years also saw the founding of a number of historically Black colleges and universities, including Morehouse College and Fisk and Howard Universities. The Freedmen's Bureau also established a savings bank, chartered by Congress, to help 4 million formerly enslaved people gain financial freedom. The bank's exclusive mission was to offer Black people generally, and Black Civil War veterans specifically, a safe place to deposit and grow their money. Black veterans were among the bank's first depositors, climbing out of the war with back pay and enlistment bonuses. There was also the promise that after generations of working land they could never own, the formerly enslaved would be compensated. During the war, the Union Army had torn through the South and seized a bountiful amount of farmland and property owned by Confederate families. A contingent of so-called radical Republicans in Congress, led by Thaddeus Stevens, argued that the seized land should be handed over to the formerly enslaved. It would be a form of poetic justice, but also retribution. They figured the redistribution of land would effectively break the back of the traitorous Southern aristocracy. In January 1865, after meeting with a group of Black ministers, General William Sherman issued an order reallocating hundreds of thousands of acres of white-owned land along the coasts of Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina for settlement by Black families in 40-acre plots. He also said the Army would give these families a mule, hence the phrase, 40 acres and a mule, which reverberated across the South. But after Lincoln was assassinated in April 1865, his vice president, Andrew Johnson, a Democrat and a former senator from Tennessee, assumed the presidency, and these policies began to change. The following year, Johnson declared, "This is a country for white men, and by God, as long as I am president, it shall be a government for white men." Over the next decade, the nascent gains of the Reconstruction era would gradually be undone. From the beginning of his presidency, Johnson insisted that land seized from Confederates must be returned to its former owners, effectively undoing Sherman's order and returning to former enslavers the land that had been seized from them as punishment for taking up arms against the nation. Some 40,000 Black families had settled on confiscated Sherman land. In some cases, federal troops evicted them by force. In others, Black people fought off returning white people with guns. According to some accounts, about 2,000 Black landowners held on to the land they'd been given after the war, but the majority stayed on land they no longer owned and worked as sharecroppers. Reneging on the land was just one way the federal government betrayed these upstart Americans. The Freedmen's Bureau, always meant to be temporary, was dismantled in 1872. More than 60,000 Black people had deposited more than $3 million into the savings bank, but its all-white trustees used that money to begin issuing speculative loans to white investors and corporations. When the bank failed in 1874, Black depositors lost much of their savings. By that time, Reconstruction was nearing its end. White Southerners had staunchly refused to accept the fullness of Black freedom, let alone Black equality, and fought hard to maintain the pre-war tenets of white supremacy. They despised the federal troops in their midst and argued for home rule to be restored. Following the presidential election of 1876, which came down to disputed returns in Florida, Louisiana, and South Carolina, Southern Democrats agreed to what became known as the Compromise of 1877. Republican Rutherford B. Hayes was installed in the White House, and the federal government pulled out the last Union troops from the South. The results were devastating. Over the course of the next generation, white violence prevented black people from casting ballots, and southern state legislatures began to revert to all-white rule. The black activism of the previous decade would continue only within increasingly violent and narrow strictures. Starting in the 1870s, in the period of so-called redemption, lawmakers throughout the South enacted Jim Crow laws that stripped black people of much of their newfound freedom. Other white people, often aided by law enforcement, waged a campaign of terror against black people that would go on for decades. In fact, white political violence stretched well into the 20th and early 21st centuries, taking on new and more insidious forms that continue to unsettle black life in America today. Some of this historic violence was spurred by what was seen as violations to social codes, including consensual sex between black and white adults, a lack of proper deference to white people, and black workers demanding fair wages or fair treatment. Black political progress was also seen as an affront. But black people's financial success often seemed to provoke the harshest response, especially from white people who felt threatened by a real or perceived rise in African American prosperity. With limited opportunities to accumulate wealth or even financial stability, black folks had to work extraordinarily hard and strike just enough luck to cobble together a living. Gathering the means to educate their children and keep their families safe was a full-time mission, a tough one, given that nearly all of them started with nothing. Again and again, when black people did manage to build any kind of success, they were met with violence. In 1898, armed white people stormed Wilmington, North Carolina, an affluent, majority black city. The biracial Fusion Party had managed to win election to a number of city offices, enraging white supremacists in the area, who plotted a violent overthrow of the local government. The mob murdered dozens of black residents and forced thousands of others to flee their homes in what remains, to this day, the only successful coup in U.S. history. 2 decades later, in 1921, in one of the bloodiest racial attacks ever in the United States, a white mob burned and looted another prosperous black community, the Greenwood neighborhood in Tulsa, Oklahoma. As many as 300 black people were killed, and some 10,000 were rendered homeless. 35 blocks were destroyed. No one was ever convicted in any of these acts of racist violence. In the same year as what came to be known as the Tulsa Race Massacre, a case in Georgia captured national attention. Federal officials were investigating a farmer in Jasper County for using peonage, a form of involuntary servitude based on indebtedness that was outlawed in 1867. Through this practice, the farmer had effectively enslaved a number of black men. To conceal his actions from investigators, the farmer murdered the men working for him. Governor Hugh M. Dorsey responded to the national outrage over this episode by decrying the vast extent of peonage, lynching, and cruelty in his state. In some counties, the Negro is being driven out as though he were a wild beast, Dorsey said in an address in Atlanta that summarized a series of allegations about mistreatment of black people in Georgia. In others, he is being held as a slave. In others, no Negroes remain. To me, it seems that we stand indicted as a people before the world. If the conditions indicated by these charges should continue, both God and man would justly condemn Georgia. Dorsey told the story of a well-respected black farmer who managed to save enough money to buy a 140-acre farm where he lived with his wife and 12 children, three of whom were teachers. The farmer even earned praise in the local paper for raising $12,000 in Liberty Bonds to support U.S. war efforts. But after the article was published, his neighbor, an illiterate white man, said, "He's getting too damn prosperous and biggity for a nigger." Not long after, the white neighbor had a property line drawn 25 feet into the black farmer's land and dared him to cross it. Days later, when the black man and four of his children went into town, a marshal served him a warrant for trespassing. When the man asked what he'd done, the marshal replied that he would rather kill the Negro than read the warrant. The marshal then attacked the man, pistol whipping him to the ground. A group of white men jumped in and began to choke and beat him. As his daughters rushed to help their father, a man kicked one of them in the gut. The family was overpowered by the mob and dragged to jail. The man and one of his daughters were badly injured. Three of the man's daughters were charged with resisting arrest, and his son was charged with carrying a pistol, despite the fact that he did not have one. The next day in jail, the family learned that their neighbor had told the police that the black man had been trespassing on his property. With the man in jail, a mob led by the town marshal went to his house in the middle of the night while his wife and younger children were sleeping. The mob kicked down the door and then shot up the house. The family fled the next morning. A friend went back the next night and removed the family's livestock and sold it for much less than it was worth. Their crop was a total loss. They never returned. They'd been warned that if they did, they'd be lynched. The father was sentenced to 12 months on a chain gang and fined $250. The daughters were fined $50 each. The son was fined $100. The education of his children and the success of his thrift seemed to be the sole offense of the Negro, Governor Dorsey said. He outlined a series of remedies for these injustices, but strenuous objections from many Georgians prevented any significant reform. With violence largely sanctioned by state and local governments, black families, especially in the South, faced poverty coupled with a life in limbo, where safety, stability, access to education, and mental health were always precarious. This was true for many generations. Today, black Americans, far removed from slavery and Jim Crow, continue to be handed the economic misfortune of their forebears. This is why, as of 2017, white households were twice as likely as black households to receive an inheritance. And when white people inherit money, it's typically three times the amount black beneficiaries get. Those inheritances help drive the racial wealth gap. Receiving an inheritance boosts the median wealth of white families by $104,000, but for black families, it's just $4,000. For most black citizens, passing down a more substantial financial inheritance or a business such as the one Elmore Bowling was building when he was killed has been and remains a dream out of reach. Instead of wealth, millions of black families have passed down something else from one generation to the next: the mental and emotional stress that results from the constant threat of white violence and financial insecurity. Within a year of Elmore Bowling's murder, nearly all of the family's wealth was gone. White creditors and people posing as creditors took the money the family made from the sale of their trucks and cattle after the killing. Some others, without a shred of proof, claimed that Bowling owed them money. Bertha May feared what would happen if she didn't pay them. They even staked claims on what was left of the family's savings. With Bowling gone, there was no one else to run the many arms of the family business. Seemingly overnight, the Bowlings went from prosperity to poverty. "My father's murder actually killed aspirations for black people," says McCall, referring to not just her family, but all of the people who worked in their various enterprises. Everyone had to go back to working for plantation owners. No one wanted to take over the business. My father had brothers, and when someone came in to ask my uncle, "Are you going to take over Elmore's business?" he said, "No, that's what got him killed." Less than 2 years later, the family fled Lowndes County in the dark of night, fearing for their lives. They found refuge in Montgomery, where Bertha May was employed in domestic work. Over the next few decades, the family would remain financially and emotionally adrift. Eventually, Some of the Bolings were drawn north by the Great Migration, while others joined the military and went overseas. There were marriages and divorces, births and deaths. Yet there was one consistent force connecting their fates, the rippling effects of Elmore's murder. No generation would fully escape. Of the seven siblings, Lewis, Elmore Jr., Willie D., Robert, Mary Magdalene, Morris, and Josephine, only Josephine, the youngest of the Boling children, managed to earn a college degree. A college education isn't the sole marker of financial or social stability, but for the Bolings, as for most families, those with more education fared better. The men struggled the most, primarily working as low-paid laborers. "I am the only college graduate," McCall says, which is a shame, because my father really emphasized education. She described to me why she thought her path was different from those of her siblings. One day, when she was in high school, she told her English teacher that she was interested in a new trade program at the school that allowed students to spend part of the day in class and part on a job site. Her teacher balked, "No Boling, you don't want that. You're college material." In that moment, McCall made up her mind to set her sights higher. She eventually enrolled at Alabama State College, one of the state's 15 historically black colleges. McCall's mother, who'd left school in the sixth grade, helped pay her tuition with money she earned working at a local dry cleaner. McCall went to class during the week and then spent Friday evening through Sunday evening working for a white family, taking care of the children. After graduating with a degree in physical education and science, she got married and had two children. She worked as a teacher and a school psychologist and later became the first black president of the Alabama Association of School Psychologists. Both of her children graduated from college. Unlike some of her older siblings, McCall has very little memory of the day her father was killed. But she has watched its long, slow fallout her entire life. Her oldest brothers, Lewis and Elmore Jr., were 15 and 14 years old when the men came for their father. Before then, they were being groomed to be the brains of their father's expanding business operation. Instead, the eldest two Boling boys dropped out of school not long after their father's murder. Lewis married young and worked menial jobs before he was drafted into the army and served a tour in Korea. He eventually divorced, remarried, and started a taxi business. "My father always told them to work for themselves, and they took that literally," McCall said. But Lewis's taxi business faltered after a few years, and he took a job at a local bowling alley. He spent the next 41 years there before retiring. His second marriage also ended in divorce. He managed to save enough money to buy a plot of land in Montgomery and have a solid brick house built on it. He still lives there to this day, but he'll never be his own boss again. Elmore Jr. spent much of his adult life employed in fairly menial jobs, including stints at a chemical plant and a food distributor, sometimes as a manager. He became a minister in a bit of a spiritual nod to Elmore Sr., who had been a deacon at their childhood church. But he was unable to find the freedom that his father had told him would come with smarts and hustle. He learned that lesson the hard way. Elmore still feels the sting of being passed over for a higher-paying position. Instead, it was given to a less experienced white man he trained. Of all the boys, Willie D., who was 12 when their father died, struggled the most. Elmore had called Willie D. his head man and had trusted him to get his four younger siblings to school each morning while his older brothers were away in the city. He also ran the family store part-time, and he was the one who witnessed the most on the day his father was murdered. Willie D. could never shake the sight of his father's brutalized body lying in that ditch. He too quit school. As a young man, he worked odd jobs, handing over all of his pay to his mother. He eventually got married and found jobs at a Coca-Cola plant, a lumber company, and a wine company. As a young husband, he took his pregnant wife to Chicago, looking for better prospects. But he found little in the so-called promised land of the North. Before he could lay down roots, he headed back home to Alabama. For a while, he worked with his brother Lewis, driving taxis. But his life was filled with struggle. He had 8 kids and worked multiple jobs to put food on the table. Then he had a seizure. Around that time, his wife left him, taking their youngest kids to Georgia. Mental illness tightened its grip, and Willie D. was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. McCall remembers one especially troubling episode not long after his wife and children moved out, when he barricaded himself in his house with a loaded gun. The family arrived ahead of the police and talked the gun out of his hand. After that, the Bowlings made the painful decision to have Willie D. committed to a psychiatric facility. He spent the rest of his life in and out of mental institutions, struggling to stay on his meds. Over a number of days in the early 2000s, he sat with McCall, who at the time was writing a book about their father's lynching, to tell her what he remembered about that day. Details he'd kept locked inside for more than 60 years poured out of him. The white men who came to the store looking for his father, the terror he felt, helplessly watching the men's car tail his father's truck on the highway near their store, the sounds of gunfire, his father's dead body. He'd even tried to peel the boots off his father's feet because of a saying he'd heard about not being able to get into heaven with them on. McCall says that Willie D's unrealized potential still pains her. He could fix anything mechanical, and he had a sharp mathematical mind and his father's business acumen. She thinks he could have been successful. He died of leukemia in 2007 in Montgomery. Robert, Mary Magdalene, and Morris all took different paths. McCall says that Robert, who was 10 years old when his father died, dropped out of school in the 8th grade and later struggled with alcohol abuse. He got married and headed north to Chicago, hoping to break the curse that had befallen his family. But trouble followed. His marriage failed, he couldn't find work, and one of his 3 children, a teenage son, was shot and killed in Chicago. Robert returned to Alabama to bury his son and later found work cleaning cars at a local Chevrolet dealership. He remarried, became a Jehovah's Witness, and lived the rest of his life isolated from the rest of the Bowlings. He died in 2020. Mary Magdalene, a year younger than Robert, was the first of the Bowlings to graduate from high school. She spent 2 years at college before getting married and joining the migration north, moving first to Chicago and then to New York City. In New York, she worked as live-in help for white families and eventually became a bookkeeper. After 23 years in New York, she returned home to Alabama to work at the Montgomery Housing Authority, where she stayed until she retired. After a rocky academic road that included repeating a grade, Morris, the youngest boy, graduated from high school. For a while, he worked for his brother's taxi service, then enlisted in the Army. Morris launched a charter bus service in Atlanta, but the business foundered after one of his buses caught fire and his insurance company jacked up his premiums. Today, Morris manages a loading dock for AT&T. Of Elmore and Bertha May's 27 grandchildren, only 8, including McCall's 2 children, graduated from college. McCall says the rest are unemployed or underemployed. They have never known anything like the prosperity of their grandparents. How might the family's trajectory have been different if Elmore Bowling had never been murdered? It's impossible to know, of course, but there's no doubt that Elmore's descendants would have enjoyed greater stability if his businesses had been allowed to grow and to be passed down to his children, who might have built on his successes and passed their own on to their own children. He had established himself as a wealthy man, McCall says, but I grew up poor. Sometimes I've wondered, what my life could have been had he lived. Looking back on her family's winding path, she can't help but dwell on her father's strenuous efforts to create prosperity for the family and how they were undermined. "Every time we take a step up," she said, "there's someone trying to crush it."